Hello, fellow theater people. Wow, it's been a minute, huh? 5 years to be exact. So listen, when we published our last episode in the summer of 2018, I really thought that was it, that my time making theater people had come to an end forever. But I guess not, theater people, because today we are back for a very special event. So a few months back, I saw on Facebook that my friend Alyssa Hurwitz, someone I actually became internet friends with during my theater people days, had made a post about a new podcast called Stage Combat. The first thing I noticed about it was that the cover art for the podcast was really interesting. It was a noir-style cartoon with a serious Mad Men vibe that seemed to show a man falling from the sky in front of what looked like it had to be the famous and iconic Goodspeed Opera House. What the hell is this, I wondered as I grabbed my phone, opened my podcast player, and sort of frantically searched for the podcast. What I would quickly learn is that the podcast Stage Combat tells the true story of an actor named Sean Hayden, who was cast as a lead in the Goodspeed's 2019 production of the musical Billy Elliot. It was a dream come true for Hayden, that is, until everything very quickly falls apart for him. I don't want to give too much away in this intro, but I became a rabid fan of this podcast right away because it's masterfully put together and it's the kind of true theater story that we never hear. One in which an actor, knowing it's going to cost him everything, breaks all the rules by standing up for himself. Stage Combat is a true crime story wrapped in a mental health journey, which is also the kind of story from the theater world which is so infrequently told. So, theater people, we're going to play episode 1 of Stage Combat for you right now. And after that, stick around for my interview with Sean Hayden, the actor at the center of this story. And just for clarity, Stage Combat is not affiliated with my podcast network, The Obsessed Network, in any way. We don't own it, we didn't produce it, we just love it, and we want you to hear it. Okay, here's episode 1 of Stage Combat, followed by my interview with Sean Hayden.
You're listening to Stage Combat, a mental health story of what really happened behind the scenes at the Goodspeed Opera House in East Haddam, Connecticut, during its 2019 production of Billy Elliot, the musical.
Stage Combat is a true story of the narrator's personal experience during his mental health journey from 2019 to 2023. This podcast contains actor portrayals of actual events. The names of the members of the cast of Billy Elliot have been changed. Stage Combat contains strong language and addresses mental illness. Check the show notes for more details. Haywood Productions LLC offered Goodspeed Musicals, Inc., and the Goodspeed Opera House Foundation, Inc., the opportunity to include a statement in each episode of Stage Combat, including an option to deny the events as depicted. They declined. Haywood Productions also offered Goodspeed's artistic director and managing director the opportunity to appear on this podcast to discuss the narrator's account of his experience at the Goodspeed Opera House. They both declined.
So, let's figure out just how I got here. It's a September Saturday night. The time, about 10:45. And I'm lying on my stomach on a dusty black floor in a small town in Connecticut. In the darkness. I can't move. I'm paralyzed. I'm vaguely aware that the kid who's playing my younger son, he's on the other side of the scrim in front of the audience. Until I'm not. From the floor, I can see the woman who plays my mother. She sees me and yells,
"Sean!"
That's me. My name is Sean. I'm the figure in the podcast cover art, the man falling out of the opera house, figuratively speaking. I know, it's a bit like an Agatha Christie or an Alfred Hitchcock film. But I'm not in an Agatha Christie or a Hitchcock film. I'm in a stage production of Billy Elliot the musical. And I'm in a complete nightmare.
This is Season 1, Episode 1 of Stage Combat. Welcome to the good speed.
I should tell you something right up front. Nobody dies in this podcast, just so you know. So this story, it can't be that bad, right? I mean, that's what we say. It's not like anybody died or anything. But there is a body on the ground. This is the diary of an actor who collapsed on the stage of one of the most powerful theaters in the country. But trust me, there's a lot more to this story than just that. And to learn what really happened, we've got to go back 6 months before I collapsed on this dusty stage floor. April 2019 BP, before the pandemic. And we're at an audition in Manhattan. I'm one of the hundreds, sometimes thousands, of actors on any given day in New York City auditioning for Broadway and regional theaters all over the country. There's something else I should tell you, right up front, because I don't want you to be disappointed. I'm not anyone famous. You haven't heard of me. Some may say I'm a nobody. But you probably heard of Billy Elliot the Musical, or the 2000 movie it's based upon. It's the story of a little boy in Northern England in the 1980s who just wants to dance ballet. But he faces resistance from his bigoted father, known as Dad. Elton John wrote the rock score. It opened in London in 2005, then on Broadway in 2008, and won the Tony Award for Best Musical. And now, it was being produced by the famous Goodspeed Opera House. Goodspeed is one of the most prestigious theaters in the country. It's one of several elite regional theaters that are just one step from Broadway. But don't just take my word for it. Goodspeed itself proclaims,
"We are widely recognized as the home of the American musical."
It boasts of importing 21 productions to Broadway and being the first regional theater in the country to receive two Tony Awards. Shenandoah, Man of La Mancha, and that musical about a bunch of singing orphans, Annie, those all came out of the Goodspeed. 130,000 people visit the Goodspeed to watch 400 performances each season. And that opera house? It's a four-story Victorian institution, built in 1876, listed with the National Register of Historic Places, sitting majestically like a white tower high above the Connecticut River. And all this, the world of the Goodspeed, happens in a tiny Connecticut town called East Haddam. Population, 8,875. But there's another thing about Goodspeed. It has big money. I'm talking about the kind of money most theaters only dream of. According to ProPublica, in 2019, Goodspeed had an annual budget of about $12 million and an endowment of close to $20 million. Each June, there's a big gala where Goodspeed gives an award with its own name on it.
The Goodspeed Award for Outstanding Achievement in Musical Theater.
They give it to a musical theater legend like Julie Andrews, Chita Rivera, or Kristen Chenoweth. You can buy a producer's level table for $10,000. Then there's the real estate. Millions and millions of dollars of real estate, anchored by that opera house. There's several rehearsal studios. There's a huge production facility with a scene shop, paint shop, and a prop shop. There's a music library with over 100,000 items. A costume shop housing 250,000 garments. There's a separate costume rent facility with over a mile of costumes. There's an artist village for housing made up of 22 homes built at a cost of $5.5 million. Goodspeed owns the Gelston House, a restaurant and tavern built in 1853. And did I mention Goodspeed owns a second theater? It's in nearby Chester, Connecticut. And the people who work in this real estate make some pretty good money. In 2019, Goodspeed paid its executive director compensation of over $338,000. That executive director is a man named Michael Gennaro. And he has a dream.
Yeah, it's always been my dream to put Billy Elliot on the stage. This show has such great heart.
In 2019, Michael Gennaro's been the executive director of the Goodspeed for the past 4 years. A former lawyer, he came to Goodspeed from Trinity Repertory Theater in Providence, Rhode Island. He replaced the legendary Michael Price, who ruled the Goodspeed for a whopping 46 years. But Gennaro's choice of Billy Elliot was a strange addition to the Goodspeed's 2019 season.
I know this show is a little different than The Music Man or Hello, Dolly.
Goodspeed was known for classic musical theater productions, and its audiences, largely conservative, older. Billy Elliot, on the other hand, is a foreign, gritty story set in the 1980s, with lots of onstage violence. Act 1 ends with Billy screaming throughout a number called Angry Dance, as electric guitars blare out into the audience. And the script? It's loaded with F-bombs. Nevertheless, Michael Gennaro was determined to put Billy Elliot on the Opera House stage. But let's go back to that audition in Manhattan. I'm standing in front of Broadway director Gabriel Barry.
Oh, hi, Sean. Good to see you.
I'm auditioning for the role of Dad in Billy Elliot. Barry is sitting behind a white folding table.
Do you have any questions about the scene?
On the weekends, I had been appearing in a not-so-great production of The Bodyguard, the musical. So working with Barry at the prestigious Goodspeed was definitely a step up. The role of Dad is one of those mammoth roles. It requires a big presence, a lot of stamina, and complex emotional skills. And it's a tricky role. The father is despondent and grieving the recent death of his wife. He does horrible things like calling his son Billy a fruit, and he punches the other son in the face. He breaks down crying twice a show, then suddenly becomes the comic relief in the second act. He grows and changes and helps Billy achieve his dancing dreams while showing us his big heart. I didn't seek out this audition. When I got the notice from my agent and saw that it said Billy Elliot, I said, "What?" Because I didn't think I was physically right for the role, and I thought there were people who were better suited for it. Let me just ask my agent to politely decline. But then I see the production was being directed by Gabriel Barry. He had just cast me in a summer production at a prominent 1,500-seat theater near Boston. And it's really nice for a Broadway director to want to see you for two shows back to back. So I told myself, just get in there, Hayden. Don't embarrass yourself and get out. Standing in front of that white folding table in an audition studio, you're aware you have a unique career. We're called upon to reveal our vulnerabilities and our emotions to tell stories on stage and in cold audition rooms, where we bare our souls to a group of people that we usually don't even know. Sometimes they're nice. Sometimes they're indifferent. Rarely are they flat out rude, but it happens. It's the indifference that you remember. I went into Day's audition like it was another day at the office. Like I've been doing as a working actor based out of New York City for the last 20 years. And that work gave me great health insurance and a pension for my future. My good acting friend messaged me.
Jesus, you work a lot. What's your secret?
Maybe because I had 2 Broadway national tours on my resume. Or maybe, as I told him, keep studying to beat out the other actors around my age that don't study anymore. But I also studied because I loved the craft of acting. And I loved plays. And a little acting studio in a Tribeca basement allowed me on Tuesday nights to immerse myself in the classic works of Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams, as well as a lot of other great contemporary playwrights. It was a safe space to stretch and grow, admire the work of other actors, and become confident as an artist. And you know what? I was happy. I had a great long-term relationship with the best guy in the world.
Hello.
At the next table.
That's him. That's Ian. We had a little farmhouse in upstate New York. We scraped together our savings and bought it at the bottom of the market. Over the years, we renovated it. Ian built a garden, and we got married in it. And we had a little rescue dog named Lila. I know, we sound like a gay Hallmark movie. But I found happiness in my own personal journey. And my identity became husband, dog parent, actor, lawyer. Oh. We haven't talked about the lawyer thing, have we? That I'm also a lawyer? It's not something I openly share with other actors, because when they find out, I can sort of see their brains scrambling. Sometimes I see on their faces confusion, maybe a little resentment. I'm never sure. But I just try to underplay it by saying something like, yeah, I have a strange life. Shortly after moving to New York City with almost nothing, I got my first legal clients by taping flyers on lampposts in the Chelsea neighborhood. I opened a practice to help same-sex couples who at that time had no legal protections. There were tragic stories of people in the LGBTQ community losing everything when their partner died. It was rewarding to help my community. But on this particular April day, in the 12:30 p.m. time slot, I was an actor, auditioning for the Goodspeed production of Billy Elliot at Pearl Studios on 8th Avenue. In the studio that day, I surprised myself. Something happened. I connected with a role in a show I didn't think I was right for. This working-class father who was worlds apart from who I am. The audition scene was where Dad goes to see Billy's dance teacher, Mrs. Wilkinson. He wants to know if Billy is good enough to get into ballet school. She says yes, but then Dad realizes the school would cost more money than he could ever get his hands on. Billy's dance teacher tries to convince Dad to accept her help, but he can't do it. He's too proud. He says, he's my son. He's my responsibility. That got me. This man, whose back was against the wall and could not provide for his little boy. So right there in front of Gabriel Barry, I exposed Dad's inner pain and my own vulnerability. In front of executive director Michael Gennaro, sitting with a big grin on his face. And in front of producer Donna Lynn Hilton, sitting expressionless with her arms folded. But trust me, later on, she's going to have plenty to say. Over the years, I had actually learned to enjoy auditions. I didn't even get nervous anymore. Because an audition is an opportunity to do what you love to do. Your job that day is just to create a little piece of art and leave it in the room. It's up to the people behind the white folding table to decide what to do with it. 3 days later, I'm called back for a second and final audition. They send me a song to learn at 11 p.m. the night before the callback. Great. This kind of stuff happens all the time, but you do just learn to roll with it. It's a folk song. It's called Deep in the Ground. In the song, Dad is drunk and he's singing about his wife who recently died. Still grieving, he's unable to finish the song, so Billy finishes it for him. The next morning, I have just minutes to learn the song at Shetler Studios. Then I jump into a cab to run downtown to Pearl Studios for the callback. As I'm sitting in the holding area, I see a Broadway star who has just auditioned walk out. Well, shit, he's amazing. But then I think, today, I don't care. I'm just going to do my thing. And now I'm standing in front of the same people from the first audition. Gabriel Barry, Michael Gennaro, Donna Lynn Hilton, still sitting behind her folded arms.
Oh, and this is the choreographer.
But now there's also choreographer Mark Kimmelman. I have no fear. I go for it. I guess it was one of those auditions that we actors dream about. Does that sound like bragging? I don't want to be that guy. But it was raw, visceral, honest, controlled messiness. I use my water bottle as a beer. I sloppily gulp it down in between the verses as Dad plunges deeper into his grief. Water drips from my face. I'm in my zone, in my box, telling the story. The pianist plays Billy's last notes in the song, as if Billy is singing them. I look into the pianist's eyes as if he's Billy, and he looks back at me, and I deliver the last heartbreaking line to him. Merry Christmas, son. And I knew that no matter what happened, I would always have that beautiful moment that I created in the room. 8 days later, I learned that that audition has booked me the role of Dad. It's a really big deal for me. As actors, we work a lot of not-so-great jobs just for the opportunity to step up. And I think maybe my years of continuing to study acting, even as I get older, are paying off. Because Goodspeed typically hires Broadway stars, and I'm not a Broadway star. This will open doors for me. Doors that don't typically come for someone of my age. I think of my husband attending the opening night and all the bad shows the poor guys had to sit through. I email my agent. Just want to say to you that this is a dream come true for me, and I appreciate you being my advocate. The world is full of possibilities. On August 12th, 2019, I leave New York City for East Haddam on a sunny, beautiful day. My vehicle travels on I-95 through Connecticut and exits off the interstate. The landscape starts becoming more rural, quieter, and the city seems worlds behind us. 2.5 hours later, we enter into a small town, past a smattering of small businesses, a diner, a dollar store, a Dunkin' Donuts, and finally, the steel swing bridge, taking me over the Connecticut River into East Haddam. And I see the Goodspeed Opera House for the first time. A four-story Victorian white facade, gleaming in the sun. I actually gasped. It was so dramatic. An Americana fairy tale supersized. I smile as the van drives over the bridge, having no idea what will be looming behind the doors of the Grand Opera House. Because I will soon encounter behind those doors, how do I say this? You see, it's ingrained in us. As actors, there's an unspoken rule in our industry, a rule that says you are not supposed to speak up. You are not supposed to disturb the status quo. It is in your best interest to not appear to be a problem, or there will be consequences. This rule, in an industry where people are afraid, terrified, to speak the truth. But I am going to speak the truth. Right here, in this podcast. Behind the doors of that opera house, I would find people who would destroy my mental health, who would destroy my career, who would take away from me what I have always loved to do. And that fairy tale opera house would become, in my mind, a house of horrors.
Haywood Productions offered the Goodspeed the opportunity to include a statement within this episode. The Goodspeed declined. Goodspeed's artistic director and managing director declined an invitation to appear on this podcast to discuss the narrator's account of his experience at the Goodspeed Opera House.
Hi, Sean Hayden.
Hi, Patrick Hines.
So, number one, welcome to the Theater People podcast, which I gotta tell you, are not words I ever thought I would say again after the year 2018.
It's been a while, right?
It's been a while.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I'm breaking the silence of the Theater People podcast universe because what happened was I discovered your podcast, Stage Combat, became rapidly obsessed with it, and just wanted to like try to figure out a way to get it to more like theater people.
We love that.
And I was like, look, I'm reviving Theater People for a special episode. We're going to play episode one of Stage Combat and then just do an interview and sort of talk about it. So here we are.
Yes, and we're all for it. Yes.
My last guest was Laura Benanti in August of 2018.
So went from Laura to me. I
to
feel
you.
Very, very honored.
Yes. Well, hi, welcome.
Thank you.
I love your podcast.
Thank you, Patrick.
So anybody who is hearing this will have just listened to episode one. And I was trying to think of a way. Can you describe your podcast in a spoiler-ish free way that will make people understand like what it is, and then I can gush about what I love about it?
Well, actually, I'm just going to almost quote you verbatim.
Yeah.
It is a mental health story told like a true crime podcast.
Yes.
Wrapped in a juicy backstage theater story.
Yeah. That when I was listening to it, when I found it through our mutual friend, Elisa Horwitz.
Hurwitz. Elisa Hurwitz.
Who I know through my Theater People podcast days. And she posted about it on her Facebook. And I was like, what is this? And I remember like now that I'm a podcast producer, I've already told you this, but I remember seeing the cover art and being like, oh, like this looks interesting. And it's like very noir. It's Mad Men feel, like a man falling out of the iconic Goodspeed Opera House. And I was like, what is this? And I listened to it and I was hooked immediately.
Yeah. Stage Combat is a mental health story told like a true crime podcast.
So, okay, that's a great log line, but can you tell the people a little bit about the plot of the podcast?
Yeah. The podcast is my true life story. In 2019, I was hired to play one of the leads in a production of Billy Elliot, the musical, at the famous and prestigious Goodspeed Opera House in East Haddam, Connecticut. And it was one of the happiest times of my life. But things started to go south very quickly once there were safety issues, harassment issues, and I didn't feel safe in my job. And as we show people in the very first scene of Welcome to the Goodspeed, on a Saturday evening during a performance, I collapsed on stage. My body was dragged off into the wings. I started sobbing uncontrollably. And I was having my first panic attack. And it was because of what was happening at work. So the story of stage combat told over two seasons is how that mental health crisis happened.
Yeah.
And then in season two, what the fallout is.
Yeah. And to give a little bit, just a little bit more, like how that happened is you encounter a cast member where real serious issues arise.
Yeah.
And having heard all of season one, it's kind of a journey through watching that relationship in its infancy and sort of like then completely fall apart. And sort of like, what's so amazing about it is that you are offering like in like first person account and hindsight at the same time based on what you're able to find out later.
Yeah. One of the challenges in putting the podcast together is that there's two parallel stories happening at once. There's a story I know in real time that causes my mental health crisis. And then there's this story behind the scenes that I have no idea about that I won't know, we tell the listeners, for 2 years.
Yeah.
So I have two voices in the podcast.
And that's why when I was listening to it, I was like, why aren't they marketing this as a true crime podcast? Like, this is a true crime podcast. But like you said, the mental health piece is like very important to you. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. But I wanted to sort of talk to you a little bit about I was looking at the website and the podcast hosting page. You describe getting that break of getting that job in Billy Elliot as coming like late in your career.
Yeah.
Now, to anybody who is not sitting across from me in a podcast booth, you don't look like a person who was late in any career. But I won't reveal your age, but I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit. I've had you to my house for cocktails and I didn't even ask you this then. Tell me about your acting journey. What was your career like before this?
Well, I came to New York very late in my career. I got my Equity card in Dallas, Texas. You know, if you've listened to the first episode, you also know that I'm also a lawyer.
Yes.
So I was,
which I've a zillion questions about.
Yeah. So I was always working two parallel careers, right? So I didn't come to New York until my early 30s. And I didn't come to New York to be famous. I just wanted to work. I wanted to be a working Actors Equity actor. And so, you know, I was successful in getting two Broadway tours. I got to take leads at theaters across the country. But when you get to be a certain of age, you know, an opportunity like a lead at the Goodspeed, it's huge to you because then you think, oh, then you'll be seen at the Paper Mill or you'll be seen for a supporting role, maybe off Broadway or in a Broadway show, you know? And particularly, I had been hired back to back by a Broadway director, Gabriel Barry. So to see a director have that faith in you, that confidence in you, is a big deal. And so it was an opportunity that I took very, very seriously. And so it was all the more crushing when it just all fell apart in a very serious way at the Goodspeed.
What were the two Broadway national tours?
I did the first and only national tour of The Light in the Piazza, which is on at the Encores series right now.
Yeah.
And then I did the, I think they called it the 2.0 tour of Mamma Mia.
Oh my God, that's so great.
So, you know, you could not have one show more different than the other, you know.
What's your training?
My training is I went to law school.
So you never like studied acting or musical theater?
Only privately. And here's the interesting thing, and we talk about this in season two. You know, my parents forbid it. You know?
Really?
Yeah. I was raised in a fundamentalist Baptist evangelical home.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, acting was told to me that there was something, literally the words of the devil.
Wow.
Yeah. So I had to fight my way just to get onto the stage, you know, and there's one of the cold opens in season two where I actually talk about that. So all my training was private. You know, I came to New York. I studied at the Schreiber Studio. I studied many years with the Scott Freeman Studio, and then always studied privately voice, vocal coaching. And so that's sort of what I did once I came to New York.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I have a whole line of questioning about booking a gig at the Goodspeed because, you know, I'm not an actor, but I'm like an avid theater connoisseur. And the Goodspeed, like you describe it in episode one, like there's this great moment in the episode where you talk about like pulling up to it and seeing it for the first time and it made you gasp.
Yeah.
Because it is one of those, especially in that business, like it is such an iconic It's iconic, you know?
It's iconic. You heard in the first episode, they've imported 21 productions to Broadway.
Yeah, and including Annie. Oh, my God.
Annie. It is the theater that brought
so
you
crazy.
Annie. And there is this kind of mystique about these old historical theaters.
Yeah.
And so I feel, you know, in the podcast, that Opera House really is its own character.
Yeah.
You know?
How many people did they see for the role of Dad?
I have no idea, but yeah. You can imagine on any sort of submission for a role of the Goodspeed, it has to be, you know,
hundreds,
thousands, yeah. A couple thousand, right? Every agent is going to submit, right?
I mean, how does it feel to like win the lottery, so to speak, to like be the one?
Well, it was great. I mean, you hear in the first episode, there's a Broadway star that
yes.
just went in right before me.
Yeah.
And I just kind of thought, well, shit, he's got it.
Yep.
You know, but then I say this in the podcast where I just got to the point where I just enjoyed going in and doing the work.
Yep.
And that would have been enough. I mean, that's the irony, right, Patrick?
Right.
Like, if only everything that happened in the next 3.5 years, if that had just been that beautiful audition, I would have been set.
Yeah.
I was set to go to North Shore and do a show with Gabriel Barry. I would have been happy as a king. But if only that had been what had happened.
I know. So, all right, now we got to talk about the other thing here, which is that you are an attorney. So
I am.
This is so interesting to me because I think one of the reasons I love this story so much or one of the reasons I was so into this story is because, like most people who've experienced bullying in their lives, I just hate bullies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what it made me think about is, you know, I've heard horrendous stories from friends who worked on Broadway. One that I can think of in particular that really broke the spell of Broadway for me. I have a friend who was in a big, fancy Tony Award-winning musical, and her colleague, her coworker on the musical with her, was like horrendously sexually assaulted by one of the union crew guys. And like both of them told me the story kind of chuckling about it because they knew there was absolutely nothing they could do. They didn't even report it because they knew nothing would happen. And all that would happen is the retaliation that would happen against her at the theater.
Yeah.
And so that is the first instance of me having a peek behind the curtain. And now I literally worry about actors when I go to see shows. If I'm enjoying a Broadway show,
and we should.
I think, oh my God, is somebody on that stage experiencing some kind of horrendous thing, and like they can't do anything about it. And I want to talk a little bit about your decision to do something about it, but I want to talk about you being an attorney, how that happened, and if that played a role in your ability to stand up for yourself in this way.
Well, the way it happened as an attorney is kind of what I said before. It was just sort of, and I loved law. So, but it was always laid out by my family. They did not come from, you know, educated roots. So it was very important to see, you know, I came from a very, you know, lower middle class family in North Florida in the Deep South. So, you know, just that was always the path. But I loved law. It was always what I wanted to do. I just wanted to do both.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of did it play a role in me being able to tell my story? Abso-fucking-lutely.
Yeah.
You know?
Because I think about how anybody who experiences, like that person I was just talking about, what do they think their recourse is? What do they know? What are their rights? Who do they even go to? How do you blow a whistle and maintain any kind of like level of safety at your own job? And I'm wondering if you actually had some insight into that as an attorney.
Well, that's so much the part of the story of season two as to not only what happens to me, but what actions I choose to take. But let's just break it down. You know, obviously, I think what a lot of people have responded to in season one is the investigative quality.
Yeah.
Because it feels like a true crime podcast.
100%.
But it just happens to be my own life.
Yeah.
You know, so when we're saying at 11:27, someone sends an email.
Oh my God. Right? I love it. I mean, it is so well done.
So that is very much the attorney part of me. But to even be able to tell the story, you know, that's just not skills that your average actor is going to have.
Yeah.
So then think about that, just being able to advocate for yourself. To say I need X, Y, and Z, and to say, as I do in the podcast, this is happening. I'm concerned about this. This is an environment of harassment. I want this to stop. And let's take it one step further. Now, you're not a white, male, cisgendered person.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a minority, you know, so you're marginalized. So now there's other obstacles for you to be able to speak up yourself,
yeah.
to feel like you have a right to speak up. And that's something that Elisa Hurwitz has been really good about talking about in some of the talkbacks in season one. So when you put all that together, it's a bit depressing as to how everything is sort of stacked up against you as the actor
yeah.
when you're going up against something as powerful as the Goodspeed Opera House.
And that's my big question was, like, how did you and why did you, like, what was the moment when you said, fuck it, I'm doing this? Like, fuck it, I have to tell this story. Because the other option would be you're a successful lawyer, you have a wonderful husband and a beautiful house upstate. You could have tried to just recover from what you experienced, get well, and go on with your life and not fear being sued by an organization with millions of dollars or yep. whatever. So what was the break for you? Whereas a lot of people try to take care of themselves and move on because they feel like they don't have resources
yeah.
or don't know how. What was the moment where you were like, fuck it, I'm blowing it all up?
Well, look, I'm a lawyer. It's my job. I'm not a litigation lawyer. You know, I represent people in real estate transactions, in probate. I draw up their wills and their legal documents, but I'm always an advocate for my clients.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also very empathetic towards my clients. And you think, if I can't advocate for myself, then what kind of lawyer am I? You know, that I dedicate my life to my clients. I
yeah.
love my clients. So that's just inherent in who I am, you know. Where I found it also was the support of my husband.
Yeah.
You know, this wasn't just something.
God bless the husbands, right?
Right. You know firsthand,
yeah.
right? So a mental health crisis is not just happening to the person it's happening to. My husband, Ian, was side by side with me.
100%.
Everything that the Goodspeed did to me, they did to my husband as well. You know?
Yep.
And he was very much supportive of me fighting back. And then, you know, actually what went into the actual impetus of putting, saying, we're going to do a podcast, that's very much the story in season two.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. As a podcast network owner, you know, we've made investigative podcasts on this network and we got sued. Like, I've been in this. We won the lawsuit after 2 years and we were in the right and we fought. We could have settled and we didn't because I asked our Pulitzer Prize winning journalist if we were right. And she said yes. And so we fought and we won. And it cost a lot of money and a lot of resources, but it was the right thing to do. What did you, going into making this podcast, how do you work in the construction of every episode to do the best you can to make sure you're on the right legal footing and telling the story?
I knew that it was never a matter of me just picking up a microphone and telling my story. I knew what I was up against and the entity that I was up against.
Yeah.
So I knew that the scripts had to be meticulous. So the worst parts of this story are from the Goodspeed's own internal documents.
Yes.
We're just dramatizing what they gave us. And you'll learn in the Everyone Wants to Know, how did you get the documents? That's season two.
Okay.
So we'll wait to see if that's
because
what
we're
it
talking,
is.
You got emails and text messages and memos.
Handwritten
notes. I mean, oh my God.
Right. So what we did was, the scripts, we wrote the scripts, but then they were footnoted like a legal brief.
Oh, wow.
So everything, you know, the general manager says this, and we have the date and timestamp of her email and to whom it's to, you know. And
make
then,
it a phone call, everybody. Make it a phone call.
Everything was notated like that.
Yeah.
And then it went through a defamation lawyer, and he read every line. And then, and he said, gave us the okay. And then once we recorded the episode, any revisions that happened in the script, it
yeah.
went back to the defamation lawyer. So, you know, it was layers and layers of being.
It's
really
a true crime podcast, Sean. I'm sorry.
You know, it pretty much is.
Yeah.
But it happens to be a mental health story. So was there always that fear in my mind because of who I'm up against? I don't want to say fear because I lived the last 3.5 years of my life in fear.
And that's why people don't speak up.
And that is why people don't speak up. So I said, look, am I aware of what I'm up against? Yes. But I'm not going to be afraid to tell my story. And I'm going to go over and beyond to
yeah.
protect myself, to make sure that the story is accurate, it is meticulous, and that it is truthful.
Well, to that end, at the top of every episode, and then at the end, I'm going to read this because I just love it. It's my and Steve's favorite part of every episode. It says, your production company offered Goodspeed Musicals, Inc. and the Goodspeed Opera House Foundation, Inc. the opportunity to include a statement in each episode of Stage Combat, including an option to deny the events as depicted, which is genius. And they decline. Also offered Goodspeed's artistic director and managing director the opportunity to appear on the podcast to discuss the narrator's account of his experience at the Goodspeed Opera House. They both declined. What has been your communication with Goodspeed throughout this process?
Well, what I can say, because it is part of season two, is that they have made their position known how they feel about there being a podcast.
Which is that they hate it, I would assume.
They're not thrilled about it because it's not a good look, right?
It's not a good look.
What happened to me was really bad.
Yes.
And it gets worse in season two. So, you know, that language was a recommendation by our media lawyer. And
yeah.
We included that. And then, you know, you'll also learn in season two where we made those overtures.
Yeah.
That's part of the story.
You know, it's interesting. One of the reasons I think Goodspeed can stay quiet is because the Broadway press, by and large, has not picked up this story. And, like, I get so fucking mad about that. Like,
why do you think that is, Patrick?
Because they're scared. I mean, I remember when I was making theater people full-time, like, even I, as, like, I'm an outsider in the business, you got to be careful who, even the politics of who you invite on the podcast versus who you don't. I mean, I'm looking at Playbill, Theater Mania, Broadway World, you know, all the big outlets that are constantly coming up on my newsfeed. Why aren't they writing about this? At the very least, they should be talking to you about your experience. You know, in a world of Me Too and in a world of all of this other stuff, there's such an opportunity, especially because everybody knows what goes on in a lot of these theaters. There's such an opportunity here to open a dialogue, have a conversation, make the world that you work in, that you love, a little bit safer. And they are not doing it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, we have had not one, but two teams of publicists reach out to these organizations. Our invitation still stands, you know.
Yeah.
We have tagged them in our social media. We are ready to talk.
I'm tagging them in my social media.
Please do. You know, and we do want to say that Onstage Blog did come out and has been supportive of the podcast and is kind of continuing the work that they do about transparency of issues in the theater. And I applaud.
But they reached out to Goodspeed and Goodspeed had no comment, correct?
That is what the article said.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a bit, I'm confused because I know these organizations carry articles about mental health.
Yes.
And let's face it, this is a real groundbreaking podcast. It gives you an unfettered look at what no one says.
Right.
And dramatizes in a way that you can experience it firsthand.
Yeah. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the experience, and maybe this is a little too personal and you can tell me if it is. Like the experience of listening to the podcast makes it feel like you've never had mental health struggles ever until this happened. Is that accurate? Like, I mean, was this a real breaking point in a way that you'd never experienced?
It was. The only time I had a real mental health struggle, Patrick, was when I came out.
Yeah.
You know, when I came out as a young man living in the Deep South in an evangelical family. So I did have some therapy for that. But in terms of having a panic disorder, an anxiety disorder, collapsing, this had never happened to me. So when it happened, I had no vocabulary. It was a completely foreign event. And so to not have that support was even more crushing.
Yeah.
Because you can imagine you're 2.5 hours away from the city. So there is no therapist to call.
Right.
There is no psychiatrist to call. There were no resources made available to me. There was no behavioral health consultant hired, like some productions can do, which can navigate an actor to resources if they need them.
But I mean, what is also so interesting is that, like, it's laid out so beautifully in the podcast. At every turn, it feels like this situation could have been handled early on and circumvented this whole thing. This didn't need to happen.
Yeah, I think my story is kind of what happens when one failure builds upon the one before it.
Yes.
You know, and it's very easy to see. You know, we had charts and you can circle right here. You know, here was an inception point where you could have stopped it.
Yes.
You know, here's the first email to the stage manager. Here's the next event when I have the air knocked out of me or I'm knocked down. And it's like all these little points, but just nothing gets done. And So I think what the podcast successfully does, it shows, at least for what I'm aware of, how each one of those moments keep building.
Yes.
That you think, oh, now I know why the guy was on the floor at the beginning of episode one.
Yes. And it's interesting. Something you said to me privately was that, like, it's an industry where a lot of the people who are in a position to, like, hire actors don't like actors.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. You know, are some people in power failed actors who didn't make it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, right. That's just how I hypothesize, yeah. Right? Is it because...
Wasn't Gabriel Barry in Starmites?
You learned that in episode two. Yes, he was.
What my last couple of questions. What is your advice to somebody who is right now hearing this and is experiencing feeling unsafe in their professional theater job? Do you feel like you've learned anything that you can impart to that person to help?
Yeah, look, first of all, you have to speak up.
Yeah.
But if you are speaking up and you are not being heard, no job is worth your health. The $1,100 I made a week at good speed was not worth the hell of my life that I went through for the next 3.5 years.
Yeah.
You know, so I think I would encourage, and of course, this is something that, you know, people a generation younger than me are much more willing to do. Go to your social media and expose what is happening.
Yeah.
Because that is the only thing I feel like a lot of theaters are going to respond to. Now, that may cost you another job there, but it's got to be where, look, this is rampant.
Right.
I mean, you would not believe the people that write to me every day, message me every day, that it's going on. And we have to start speaking up about it. So if you are going to your stage manager, your director, the general manager, the producer, and you are being ignored, I would also say this. I think I put a lot of faith in that they were just going to do the right thing.
Right.
Looking back, I would say, when can I hear back from you? Are you going to let me know what you're going to do about Chad tomorrow?
Yeah.
You know? But I was trying to be, you know, not make too many waves, but make
you're trying to not be labeled as difficult.
Which had already happened.
Right. Which you didn't know, right. You wouldn't know about for a
you
couple of
know.
Years.
Yeah. Right, right. So I think you had to be very precise. You know, this has happened. When can I expect a response back from you? And then if you're still not getting it, and you go to your agent, you go to your union. But look, by that time, you know you're working for an employer that does not care about you.
Yeah.
So you have to ask yourself, is my health, is my life, is it worth it? Because there are plenty of people, Patrick, that do not have an Ian, my
yeah.
husband, to go home to, that would end up in a far worse position than I did.
Yeah.
You know, my medical bills, you would not believe what I paid out of pocket. I was able to do that because I'm also a lawyer, and there's plenty of actors who would not have those resources.
Yeah.
So it took a team of people, and you'll hear about this in season two, to get to where I'm having a conversation with you, with the press.
Yeah.
So you just got to decide. If you speak up, ask for specifics on action, and then if you're not getting it, be prepared to walk the hell out of there.
Because I'm wondering if you're going to talk about this in season two, because this isn't a situation that ended when your job at the Goodspeed ended.
Not
this
at
followed
all.
You for 3 years.
Yeah.
And do you delve into that more in season two?
It's an epic season. So
yeah.
season two... Wow, don't even say season three. Season two actually ends in April of 2023.
Oh, wow.
And it picks up the day after season one ends. So it is a 3.5 year mental health journey, but the Goodspeed is involved in that journey
yeah.
along the way. So let's just say that.
Okay, when does season two premiere?
Season two premieres on July 25th.
So everyone listening, theater people, you have your homework. Go binge season one right now. You will thank me. If you're going to tweet about it or Instagram about it or TikTok about it, tag Playbill, tag all the outlets so they all know. And then let's listen to season two together because I am obsessed. And Sean will not even do me the courtesy of giving me the episodes ahead of time and letting me listen in the bingey manner in which I want to.
I don't know. Maybe we could talk about giving you the first three.
I want them now, Sean.
You know, I just want to thank you, Patrick, because, look, not only are you so incredible at what you do and what you've done with the network, but you're passionate about the theater.
Yes.
You know, and you didn't know me and you just reached out to me and said, I'm obsessed with the podcast and I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And that meant so much to me.
I feel very fortunate that you're here. It's not every person who can like have a new favorite podcast and a week later be having that guy to his house for drinks and then in the studio to do an interview. So thank you for being open to it, because some people would just think I'm crazy.
Well, absolutely. But thank you, Patrick, and this mutual admiration society that we have, which I'm all for it, is that you are willing to speak out about harmful practices, about the press being selective about what they're covering, because, you know, it's not being melodramatic to say lives are at stake.
Right. And nobody wants the Goodspeed to go away. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We just want the Goodspeed and every other theater to get better. You know, I'd love to not have to go to a show and worry about the actors when I'm just trying to enjoy Shucked or whatever. You know what I mean?
And there are things that every theater can be doing right now so that you don't have to worry about the actors that you're watching on stage.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Well, I'm obsessed. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for allowing me again to break the silence of the Theater People universe. And for the first time in 5 years, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be surprised the morning this comes out to see the little Theater People icon in their iTunes feed.
That's awesome. I'm glad we can be a part of that.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's do this again soon.
Yes, please.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Bye. All right, theater people, you heard me. Your homework is going to be to binge season one of Stage Combat right now. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, and make sure you're subscribed so that you get the first episodes of season two when the season premieres on July 25th. Hey, and while you're at it, go rate and review Stage Combat on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to help other people find it. And once again, just to be clear, Obsessed Network, my podcast network, we are just fans of the show. We have no ownership or creative control. We just want you to listen to it because we want the theater to become a safer and more inclusive place for people to work. All right, that's it for now, theater people. Hopefully it won't be another 5 years before you find me in your podcast feeds again. Big, big hugs from me, and be well.